From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 259 with guest Alan Hurt, recorded Thursday, March 22nd, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and you are listening to Run As Radio. With you today, my guest is Alan Hurt, who I guess really needs no introduction. You've been on the show a few times now. Sequel forever kind of guy. Is the latest book still the 2008 failover clustering?
It is. I'm actually working on the 2012 sort of upgrade to that, so to speak. This time it'll be more like my 2005 book, which will sort of encompass all the technologies, not just failover clustering.
Okay, so you're going a little more broadly there. Although, you know, failover clustering is one of those things people just think it's going to just work. My biggest advice when I'm involved in, you know, talking to especially developers about high reliability is like, you have to write code to make this actually seamless.
Yeah, we talked about that in the past, and I forget what show it was, but it's one of my pet peeves is the app dev guys assume it's all on the platform.
It's just magic.
And we on the IT end had to wind up patching the hell or putting, you know, band-aids on things to make things work no matter how the technology works. They didn't either put things like retry logic in or they've hard-coded names of databases and servers in to make it really flexible for us to deal with things on the back end.
Yeah, I'm of a mindset these days, Alan, that I need to simply start talking more about the DevOps thing as a whole, of just connecting the IT pros that are trying to run the infrastructure with the developers that are building the apps together in a bigger way, because we're going to drive ourselves crazy if we don't solve this.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's the historical problem where it's always been there, but with today's interdependencies, it's worse.
Yeah.
You know, technology has gotten a lot easier to deploy and a lot cheaper to deploy, but these problems have become, I think, more glaring now because of it.
Yeah, and we're expected to do more with less in less time. Like, yeah, you're right. It's just made it more and more apparent that this is where the weak spot is. But that's not today's conversation.
No, it's not. That's a whole other rat trap.
That is a good one. We should go there one of these days, because I know it's something you and I personally are passionate about.
Absolutely.
Hey, they shipped SQL 2012. I'm excited.
I am too. It's one of those things where I've seen it for a really long time.
Sure.
Some of it I couldn't talk about for a while. So, like, it's like, you know, stuff is coming, but especially when you can't talk about it, it's like, but I, there's this cool stuff and I can't. But yeah, so it's sort of finally here. I think full general availability, like through the volume channels, I think it's like April 1st.
Right.
But if you have MSD and a TechNet, you can download it now.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So, so for most everyone, it's going to be generally available at this point. What is your highlight list? I've talked with past guests about what they're going to like about 2012. Let's do this quickly and then dig into the meaty parts you like.
So, I mean, not surprisingly, all the new availability stuff is sort of number one and 1A on my list. You know, it's basically what I've been living in for the past year and a half.
Sure.
I actually work with the TAP customer, so.
It's all about availability.
Pretty much.
And I thought we had pretty good solutions before.
Well, you know, everything works, you know, but there have been some historical challenges when it comes to availability in SQL Server that Microsoft has never had, let's say, great answers for. There are workarounds, but never anything that people truly loved.
Mm-hmm.
The classic example, talking about clustering, is that there's a perception of wasted resources.
Yeah, you needed to have multiple databases, and you're running active-active, failing over to each other.
Well, not so much that, but like, let's take the historical architecture of a two-node Windows failover cluster with a single instance of SQL Server.
Right.
Because that single instance can only run on one node, it's not load balanced, there are no shared databases that way.
Right.
You've got the other node hanging out going, you know, well, I'm here.
Yeah. Can I have the database?
Right. Well, and the other thing about that is that's really correct because it's purely for availability.
Right.
But in the way that IT managers think, they want every resource utilized that they have.
Mm-hmm.
They see that as a problem. And, you know, with some of the other technologies, you know, like, for example, like, it's really hard to set up, like, a read-only reporting server or use a secondary server, even if it is, can host databases,
mm-hmm.
for something else. So in SQL 2012, what they've essentially done is kind of take some of the best parts of clustering, the best parts of database mirroring, combine them in a feature that can play well with, let's say, failover clustering instances as well, but that's separate thing. I don't want to muddy the waters here.
Mm-hmm.
And this feature is called availability groups. And it's built on a Windows failover cluster, but it doesn't mean you actually have to cluster the instance of SQL. It would just, you could just have, say, a standalone instance of SQL that happens to be on a cluster node.
Right.
And it's database level protection, but on the replicas, you can actually use them for other things, mainly two things right now. Read-only purposes, if you want.
Right.
And making backups.
Nice. You're no longer stressing your production server for backups, and if you want to do that reporting server setup, your availability cluster serves that for you.
Well, right. And, you know, the big sticking point with most people is kind of wrapping their head around the fact that there's a Windows failover cluster underneath all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need things like shared disk necessarily, unless you are using a clustered instance somewhere in there.
Right. So normally you'd be, this is some mirroring solution. So are you just streaming over the network to be in sync?
Exactly. And all the goodness that you have for mirroring, like log stream compression and automatic page repair, all that comes over from database mirroring.
Okay. Well, what's the latency like?
Well, you know, that's a big, it depends, because yeah. You still need a robust disk subsystem and good network to have this happen.
Yeah, this sounds like you want to run a cable between two NICs between these machines if it's using onboard storage.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, you want, like, say, if you can, like a 10 gig E, you know, dedicated network for this, but
yeah.
That's not going to be possible for most people.
Yeah.
And if you're doing synchronous, you know, kind of like database mirroring, your secondary I/O almost needs to be faster because it's waiting for the ACK back, so it's got to have that hardening of the log on the other side
mm-hmm.
for it to work.
Yeah.
So, and these are the little things that, those are the gotchas, but I mean, just from a pure features function standpoint, this is light years sort of from where we've come.
It does sound simpler, actually.
It is in a way. And it is in others, mainly due to the clustering bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, like now, one of the things that you can take advantage of is, so as you know, Windows Server 2008 introduced the whole multi-subnet thing.
Right.
And you can span sites a lot easier, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another big change in SQL 2012, was that just in general, with both clustered instances and now this availability groups thing, you can span to multiple sites using a single Windows failover cluster.
Nice.
So that's the first time it's been natively supported in the engine. So
yeah,
really cool.
That's what I was really getting at. It really, realistically, a few years ago, if you wanted to get serious about clustering, you bought a package solution from one of the big vendors.
Yep.
With the price tag attached.
Yep.
And a couple of their guys in white lab coats would hang out with you for a couple of weeks to get it right. And, you know, this was at least a six-figure investment to make it happen. And now it feels more like you could roll your own.
For the most part, I actually work with a lot of customers helping them get clustering up. Mainly, it's the Windows side that trips them up. The
mm-hmm.
SQL part's easy in comparison, if you ask me, because you're just installing SQL on top of Windows.
Right.
So as long as you get Windows right, you're fine. And Windows guys have made it much, much, much easier than it ever was.
Yeah.
And I kind of can't wait for Windows 8. For some stuff that's coming down the pike.
What do you see Server 8's out there. We've done a couple of shows around it. It's in the preview stage as well. What are the things that you grab onto?
So some of the stuff that I've seen, like one, for example, like dynamic quorum.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, and this is actually sort of an issue, not an issue, but one of the things that you need to consider when you're doing your availability groups is that you need to make sure you have enough stuff up. And that's the basis of quorum. Well, with dynamic quorum, essentially you'll be able to get down to last man standing, assuming you don't have some sort of immediate catastrophic failure where you go below 50% of your nodes.
Right.
And that's a really, really important concept. And they've made it so that it's automatic. So that they're basically what the Windows guys are saying is, yeah, you can manually set all this stuff up if you want, or you can let us manage it and we'll do it intelligently.
Interesting. And this reminds me of network load balancing of NLB, where the nodes themselves can negotiate the algorithm as machines drop out.
Yeah, and that's essentially what it does. And there's also another concept called voters, and you can take certain nodes in and out depending mm-hmm. on their, like, for example, in availability groups. If you're creating a read-only copy, and you never want to fail over to it, and you don't really care about it if it, you know, falls down.
Right.
You could take it out of the voters from a node perspective, and it won't be counted.
Right.
There's a hot fix for older versions of Windows, but it's built into Win 8. So, again, there are lots of improvements that way that make managing all this really easy. So you combine that node weight stuff along with the new dynamic quorum, and it can just handle it for you. It just works. You know, and they demoed it for us, and it's actually pretty awesome.
Yeah, it sounds like it's simpler. The other thing is you're implying here with node weight also that I can start using asymmetrical hardware in these clusters, because it used to be clustering was always symmetrical.
Yes, so there that actually was introduced even in Windows. They sort of backported that to Windows Server 2008. There's mm-hmm. a hotfix that allows you to do asymmetric storage. So you can, for example, have a failover clustering instance in your primary site, and maybe that's your primary form of availability. Then you're doing synchronous availability group to a different site that may be a standalone machine, all in the same Windows failover cluster, and it doesn't matter.
Wow. That is pretty exciting. I mean, again, this feels like we're simplifying this technology in a way that more people can use it with less fear.
Yeah, it doesn't mean there isn't a lot to think about, though.
Oh, sure.
And that's sort of my caveat there is, you and I have been doing this for a long time, so we get the coolness of this,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot of churn if it's a new concept for people.
Well, and you can't just turn it on and hope for the best. You really have to take this out for a spin and fail it a bunch of different ways and pound on it for a while to see that it's true.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that, you know, is a big recommendation when you start pulling out architectures like this is to know your failover conditions and test them.
Right. Yeah.
Because that will shake out any issues or things that you need to account for in that process.
Yeah. Know the things that can actually take you down. Are you architecting this with virtual machines, or is this literally a bare metal solution?
You can do both. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter.
And that lends itself to some interesting failover options where we have some secondary VMs that are basically sort of dormant until they're needed.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about failover clustering starting with Windows 2008 is that Microsoft, you know, assuming the same version for the OS, mm-hmm. let's get that out of the way. You can't mix like a Win 8 node with a Windows Server 2008 or 2008 R2. That's not going to happen.
Okay.
But the interesting bit is that as long as you pass the cluster validation process for that cluster, your nodes could be a mix of physical and virtual.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point, you know, you could have a Hyper-V host in, let's say, New York. That's your DR site, or actually New York's probably a bad location. Let's say like Poughkeepsie or something, like
right.
somewhere out, you know, a little northern. Then, but your main data center is in New York City, and that may be physical boxes.
Right. That's your big bare iron, that's what's normally handling your LTP load, and these backup sites will keep you up, but you're going to suffer for performance, but it's far more cost effective than actually doubling all the big iron.
Exactly, and I'm sure you've seen some of the announcements around the scalability enhancements they've done for Hyper-V and mm-hmm. Win8, which also touches a lot of the clustering bits, because that provides a lot of, obviously, the reliability functionality. So there's some really interesting things as going forward is when SQL Server 2012 finally supports Win8 officially that you can do now, but will be just made easier in the future.
It also seems to be moving us away, well, really putting the responsibility for DR more onto the SQL Server side and less onto, say, the SAN vendor doing is back-end replication tricks. I mean, I don't know where you fall on that particular thing, but it's always bothered me that the hardware guys were trying to protect us when really it needed to be more on the front end.
Well, when I talk to customers, I talk to them about what that stuff really is, mm-hmm. and it's kind of eye-opening sometimes, because when SQL Server does this thing, it's all transactional, obviously. Yeah. It's basing it on the transactional. It's what you care about is DBA. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking storage, you're talking block level.
Right.
Which knows nothing of transactions. So as a DBA, I care more about what SQL Server gives me.
Yeah.
But it's that traditional fight sort of is what you're hinting at in environments where, you know, the storage guy's like, I've got it, don't worry about it.
Yeah. You've got it as long as we're not concerned about transactional integrity.
Exactly. And trying to explain that to a SAN guy sometimes is like talking to a brick wall.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. But this does let the DBA be more of a DBA and handle this stuff and be a little more empowered.
This section of Run As Radio is sponsored by Secret Server, the password management software for IT admins. Secret Server helps you manage local admin passwords and service accounts the right way. Get your free 30-day trial for Secret Server at runasradio.com/secret-server. Does the storage medium matter much in this scenario now? I mean, it seems VMs were meant for iSCSI, and iSCSI seems to be dominating, even though it's not quite as synchronous as Fibre Channel. You can't argue with the price or the availability or the simplicity of it.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, it's about IOPS. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care what you're doing, be it iSCSI, Fibre, you know, SSD, Fusion I/O cards, whatever you've got. It's all about the IOPS you need, you know, and as long as you're meeting that, in essence, it doesn't matter unless there's some restriction in the way a certain feature is deployed, for example.
Right.
But beyond that, you know, I have no hard and fast rules because every customer is different.
Sure.
Now, the problem, though, is, you know, sort of to your point, iSCSI has become ubiquitous and cheap, but not necessarily good and reliable.
Interesting point.
Because, you know, you're now dependent on your network infrastructure to be robust and reliable.
Yeah.
And in all customers, it's not necessarily that. I mean, I've worked with customers who will put something like a single iSCSI NIC in their host, in their servers, thinking that's enough.
Right.
You still need to have concepts like MPIO and redundancy and reliability and best practices. I mean, just... And that's the problem with this, as we've talked about, this stuff getting easier, is anybody can deploy it, but it doesn't mean anybody can deploy it right.
I get it. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, do yourself a favor if you're thinking about doing this. Do not put your iSCSI traffic across their network traffic. It needs
Why
to be
not?
Isolated. What could go wrong?
You mean you don't want to take up all of your network bandwidth for your company by sending like a big bulk load across it?
Yeah. And just watch those poor switches glow, right? Like the traffic load is so vicious. It needs to be on its own. And I think you end up spending more on that networking gear than you do on your front side gear, just because it's so intense. It's small, but intense. Like if you're going to have 10 gig anywhere, it's going to be that iSCSI backbone.
I know. And the funny thing about that too is they've also made some subtle but important improvements in clustered instances in 2012 mm-hmm. around storage that they're not touting because they're not like sexy, put it on like a splash sheet thing.
Right.
But are really important. Like one is you can actually have a local 10PB.
Nice.
So you can have local user databases or system databases or backups. But basically, let's face it, 10PB is throwaway storage and it's expensive to put on SAN or any kind of shared storage solution.
Yeah. And it doesn't. Let's face it, I mean, SAN's fast, but isn't that fast? You can't touch sticking a little SSD in that machine.
Right, and the other part about that, too, is, you know, that to your point, that's often one of the biggest performance bottlenecks in SQL Server if you're using a lot of tempdb.
Sure.
So now you can configure it to basically work on the local node, so you can get that Fusion I/O card, plug it in, use it for tempdb, and just keep everything else somewhere else.
Yeah.
So that's nice. And the other thing is that SQL 2012 also supports SMB shares.
Interesting. Is that actually a good idea?
Yeah, it is. It's sort of a time that's come, and it's the only thing that lets you get around the drive letter limitation,
mm-hmm.
which is something that has been a historical pain point for most SQL implementations.
Yeah.
You can have mount points, but there are sometimes a pain in the butt to configure. And at this point, just use an SMB share.
Yeah, just the UNC is enough, you're fine.
Yeah, and again, sort of one thing that has me excited about Win 8 is some of the reliability enhancements they've done under the covers mm-hmm. to things like shares and SMB and making all that stuff robust and reliable really makes SMB almost cheaper and better as long as it performs right.
Yeah.
Than SAN.
Well, now you get back to, should I build an isolated SMB network for my data store? I could do it that way instead of iSCSI.
Oh, I'd love to see that implemented in some customers.
Well, I'd like to benchmark those because SMB is not a terribly efficient protocol for this. I mean, I still think iSCSI byte for byte is going to do more in less time, but you can't argue with the price tag. You can't argue with the simplicity of SMB.
Well, yeah, but if you're using, for example, 10 gig E with all dedicated stuff all the way through, and you've got a robust, you know, storage thing on the back end of that, it may perform just as good or better than some other solution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, generally, when I see decent iSCSI solutions, there's no switch involved, right? There's 8 ports on the iSCSI store, and each server is plugged directly into it.
Yeah.
And you can't argue with 3 feet of wire. It's pretty darn tight. But as soon as it gets more complicated than that, the switching gets difficult and management gets difficult, failover gets difficult. Like, all of those things are hard.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a big part of the problem, too, here, is that your storage guys don't always talk to your Windows guys or SQL guys.
Mm-hmm.
So they have no idea what anybody else needs. They just have this storage thing they just present to everyone.
Well, and we get back to this, you know, our opening digression on DevOps, which is if you don't have a network guy involved in this conversation when you're setting this stuff up, network's going to burn you. And if you don't have a storage guy involved when you're configuring as well, same thing, you're going to be surprised. Like there's little issues in each one of these things that your expertise is valuable.
Well, same thing with the AD guys, because especially now that we've got another thing using clustering, mm-hmm. which is this availability groups thing. So one of the nice things they've done, I talked a little bit earlier about how they brought the sort of some of the best bits of a few different worlds in here. So a historical problem with everything but failover clustering is that when you switch to the other server, you need to know what name that is.
Right.
Database mirroring kind of had in the connection string the failover partner, but that was a 1-to-1 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they've done is essentially you can create what's called a listener in the Windows failover cluster, and that, like a failover clustering instance, you have your applications connect to that, and your application doesn't have to care what node is hosting your traffic.
Right. So
they've found a way with database level protection to abstract that stuff.
I mean, we've been doing this on the website forever, right?
Yep.
With just the concept of a virtual IP. I don't know which node actually responded. I just asked and got a response.
All right.
So now we've got that for SQL Server. That's really exciting. That's the idea of a database farm.
Yep. And the other cool part about that, too, is you can specify, for example, in the connection string, if you want it to be read-only,
mm-hmm.
and as you set up your read-only stuff, it'll route to the node that's hosting the read-only stuff, so you won't be touching your actual primary box.
Wow. And again, not by name. Just asking the farm, I need a read-only access to this, and it'll put it to the right machine.
Pretty much.
That's beautiful. That's a real improvement. Like, okay, now you got me tingling. Like, I could solve some real problems here. Like, it's a big deal.
Now, let's talk about the only one real huge downside to this potentially, and that would be licensing.
Really?
So, you know, as they always say, there's no free lunch,
yeah.
right? Because your secondary server is now going to be used for an active use.
Right. You need
if you're going to be
it.
Doing things like read-only, you're going to have to probably license.
Well, that was true with reporting servers anyway. But it used to be I had a clustered pair with a quiet one that I didn't need to pay a license for. And then I had a separate server for my reporting server, although it could generally be standard, so it was a little less expensive. And I'd be doing mirroring to it and running it that way. But yeah, I guess that's fair. That has the license price changed? Is still per CPU?
Oh, that's the other big thing.
Uh-oh.
So SQL in 2012 has gone to a per core model.
Right.
Which, to be fair, I'm surprised it took them this long.
Yeah, you knew this was coming. you know, per CPU was fine when it was 2 or 4 cores, but now when it's 8 and 12, like, and you know it's only going to be more. All right, so we got to pay for our cores. But is the per core price gone down? And yes, I know you're not a licensing expert. Nobody is.
Yeah. You know, I think that's going to be a big old, it depends, and I will always say talk to your licensing folks, because the world of licensing, let alone Microsoft licensing, is a tricky and complex beast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that is a discussion I try and stay far away from. But, you know, I will say this, I think it will make people think about how many cores they really need.
Yeah, don't just throw more at it because you're now paying for them.
Well, right. And, you know, it's like I can go buy like a 10 core, you know, whatever system. That's great. A, do you need that? And B, do you want to pay for that?
Mm-hmm. Are you really going to utilize it?
You know, a quad core system, I will still argue, will deal with most loads.
Well, and how good are we at predicting how many cores we're actually going to need?
Well, that goes to a funny little thing called you should be benchmarking your current performance right now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of the problem, too. You know, sort of digressing back to some of our earlier discussions, is customers often don't know what they're doing or what they have in production now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go, in this case, let's say you want to go upgrade to 2012 and we switch to per core licensing. And how do you go about figuring what you've got? Well, it's easy. To some degree, if you're going to be using the same application, see what you're using now on your current hardware and make some guesstimate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not maxing out a four-core, a dual-proc four-core system, four cores in each proc system, chances are you don't need that 10-core.
Yeah.
You know, if you're maxing out, well, maybe you need some more power, but look before you buy.
Yeah. Well, benchmarking before you change is just common sense these days. It's amazing when people don't do it. You'd think, yeah. How does the core model affect the VM instances?
I'll be honest with you and say I'm not totally sure. That they have some specific stuff around that. Like, it's one of those you start reading it and you go, okay,
mm-hmm.
This is something that I'm not sure I want to have to totally understand.
Yeah.
Because once you start throwing in the what-if scenarios,
you get into this battle of what a virtual core versus a physical core. What am I actually paying for? If I could, at least I know if I'm running SQL in a VM and I only assign it four virtual cores, I'm pretty sure I only need to license four virtual cores.
Exactly. Now, the thing I will recommend to people is that I know not everybody gets software assurance, but if you're a large enough customer that you are thinking of going to 2012 and you want to potentially protect some pricing and some other stuff,
mm-hmm.
Now's the time to start looking into software assurance.
Yeah, well, this is where you talk about when you can actually find a licensing professional, and let's face it, they're hard to find.
And 2012 was so new, trying to even get a straight story right now
nobody really knows yet. But my experience when we actually did sit down with a guy from Microsoft who really knew his way around licensing is it doesn't take very long before you find out that you really want a volume licensing agreement.
Yeah.
That when you actually start putting the whole story together of what your organization is doing, these agreements make sense. Everybody's happier. You know, the heat goes down a long way.
Well, you know, that brings up another point in terms of just availability and upgrades and all that other kind of stuff is that licensing is probably a bigger cost to you
mm-hmm.
for whatever platform, not just SQL Server. I mean, Oracle, the operating system, whatever else. Your licensing cost for all your hardware and your software and all your vendors will be a much higher cost than the actual physical acquisition of hardware.
Yes. Yeah, I think hardware's gotten insanely cheap for what it is. Really has.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can get a kick-in server for like under 10 grand now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hard to spend $250 million on hardware unless you're building something really enormous.
Exactly.
So, yeah, these things have evolved in a good way. But I also find that the abstraction of hardware through virtualization is making that even more complex. That, you know, seem to be building a bit of a virtual cloud now if we're getting big into VMs.
Yeah, the thing, you know, the funny thing about all that stuff is people, you know, we're now throwing around the private cloud and mm-hmm. all that, this other stuff. When I talk to people about it, I'm just basically like, look, it's everything you've been doing. People are just calling it something else. the way I've always joked about it is, so at one point, we managed everything.
Yeah.
You know, you managed everything in-house, you own the data centers, you own the servers, you own the people.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got to the point where, all right, we want to own the people, we want to own the servers, but we don't want to own the space.
Right.
Then we got to, well, we'll let them manage some stuff. And then it got to be, well, we'll start outsourcing some stuff. And now it's, unless I'm in some really regulated government-y kind of thing, I don't care where it lives. I just need to know it's up and running and it's doing what I need it to do.
Right.
And that is the private cloud. Whether you manage it yourself for your end customers or somebody is managing it for you, it's all the same infrastructure stuff. Just we're thinking about it differently. You're providing whatever it is you do as a service.
Sure. And thinking about SQL Azure, it sure sounds like this list of features around failover and clustering came out of SQL Azure. This is exactly the way you'd think under the hood SQL Azure works.
You know, I'm not totally sure how they're doing their stuff, but I can tell you that the clustering stuff, for the most part, didn't come from Azure.
Really?
This stuff has been baking for a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point, like right now, one limitation, for example, is you can't use an Azure database as one of your replicas.
Yeah, which a darn shame, because I find that a great idea for DR, rather than having a separate, you know, failover site to just be able to push that to the cloud and light it up when you need to. I think that's a great idea.
Right, but in theory, as long as you can get a part of the same domain, you could use something like EC2.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. You could put an instance up there.
And isn't that funny?
Right? That isn't it?
That I can do this with Amazon's product, but I can't do it with Microsoft's.
I know.
How did we get here, exactly? How did this happen?
I don't know. but yeah, like there are so many interesting combinations you can have now that, you know, make it compelling. Now, the other downside to this, and I want to make sure people are aware, is that actually two things, and one's a side effect. This is Enterprise Edition only for SQL.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the database mirroring previously where Standard got some and Enterprise got more advanced,
right.
This is all Enterprise.
Yeah.
The other thing that's come out, and while I've known for a little while, it wasn't public till they released the RTM books online, is that database mirroring is officially deprecated as of SQL 2012.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. And is there a clear path of migration? Is there a wizard that'll pick up my mirrors and put them somewhere else?
Well, I mean, you could basically unconfigure mirroring and say, just configure AGs if you're using Enterprise.
Right.
If you're not using Enterprise, the picture is a little more murky.
Mm-hmm.
You could do log shipping right now or something else. I mean, now, but let me define what deprecated means in the SQL Server world.
Right.
It doesn't go away immediately.
No, we're not going to actually, it's not going to break when you upgrade.
Right. And, you know, it's still supported. It'll be in the SQL Server for probably at least two more major versions.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean you should rest on your laurels and say, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to continue to use this thing.
I mean, two more major versions means out to 2020.
Potentially. Well, depending on whatever their release cycle winds up being. So,
right.
Yeah, let's say they continue on their three-year release cycle.
Yeah.
We're looking at 2015 and 2018. So you've got another 6 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, people are pushing the panic button over this thing because I blogged about it. And I was like, we're looking at minimum of 3 to 5 years before you even probably yeah. need to think about it. Because most of you will not go to even 2012 right now.
No. And if you think you know what your databases are going to be doing for 5 years from now, you're deluded. Look at what we were doing 5 years ago.
If I knew that, I'd be a billionaire.
Yeah, who could it? You mean 5 years ago, that's before SSDs were viable, before Fusion IO, before any of that. Like, just think about how different things were in like 2007 for databases. Like, we are in a revolution. We've been moving pretty darn fast and it's keep going. 5 years from now beats me, man. I have no idea. It's going to be stunning, but I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that I think will be resolved in the next few years is a lot of those privacy issues and being able to actually use the cloud in a meaningful way for most corporations. I just think that right now that's a tough nut to crack.
Hmm. Yeah. And well, especially mixed. If I'm going to keep the app local, why would I push the data out? If I'm going to moving the app out is its own set of challenges. Like, these are not simple problems.
No.
But I also would say, in the next 5 years, when you are greenfielding apps, you're going to have to consider cloud development pretty darn seriously.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, 5 years from now could easily be, we're turning all this gear off because we've pretty much got no, it's only legacy apps that are running in this space, and we're going to start spinning them down now.
And you know, for us guys that are traditionally on-prem, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to have to look at our skill sets.
Yeah.
And see where they go. I mean, so, you know, I'm not unrealistic to that fact that, you know, even my skill sets are going to change to some degree.
Yeah, but they have already.
Absolutely.
I'm not worried about this. This is normal, right? Honestly, I'm looking forward to the new thing. There's more stuff to do, right? It's all the things we haven't had time to do because we're busy doing this.
I welcome our new technology overlord.
Well, Alan, I think we're just about out of time. Thanks so much for chatting with me.
Oh, thanks. This is great.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.